Welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Blake McVeigh, and I'm happy to welcome to the show Bob Drury. Bob is a journalist and author, co-author of 13 books, including the New York Times number one bestseller, The Heart of Everything That Is. He has written for, among others, the New York Times, Vanity Fair, Men's Journal, and GQ. He is currently a contributing editor and foreign correspondent for Men's Health. Today, we will be discussing his latest work, co-written with author Tom Clavin, entitled Valley Forge, which was published by Simon & Schuster. Welcome to the show, Drury.
Blake, thank you so much for having me here. I appreciate it.
First off, give us a little bit of background about Valley Forge, the situation of the War for American Independence that we find at the opening of the book.
Well, you know the term, the military term, FUBAR?
Yes.
That's where we were in that fall and early winter of 1777. The Continental Army, led by George Washington, was on its last pins. It had just been routed at the Battle of Brandywine Creek, where George Washington tried to stop the British from taking the nascent capital of Philadelphia. It had been massacred on a Paoli Plateau, which nobody knows about. It was truly a massacre, bayonets only. No Flint. In fact, the general in charge became known as the British general, No Flint Charles Grey, because he ordered all his British and Scottish troops to take the flintlocks out of their brown besses, bayonets only, and over 200 Americans were massacred in their sleep. Then in a last-ditch effort to regain Philadelphia, Washington tried a dawn surprise attack on the British at Germantown, which at the time was a suburb of Philadelphia, is now incorporated into the city. And he came this close, Blake. He came so close, but then a combination, this eerie fog settled over the battlefield. And the Americans, who were not trained well, friendly fire began shooting at each other. The militia, who were supposed to support the main army, did not show up. They got lost in the fog, turned into another rout. So here we have Washington, late 1777. He's basically fighting a two-front war, militarily against King George's Redcoats, and politically against a faction, predominantly New Englanders, of the Continental Congress, who want to depose him. And let me step back. We think of Washington, you look at the dollar bill. Mm. The man came out of the womb wearing blue and buff uniform, you know, maybe even riding a white horse, which is too bad for his mother if that's right. The way he came out of the womb. But what we think we have done, in fact, what we know we have done, my co-author Tom Clavin and I in this book, is we've shown Washington the man with all his insecurities, with all his foibles, with all the weight of the world on his shoulder during this winter. And it's our contention that those 6 months from December 19th, 1777 to June 19th, 1778 were the turning point of the American Revolution.
And it made me wonder, this has been so long ago, why is it just now that that sort of assertion is being made about such a key part of the American Revolution?
Well, I'll tell you a story, a little inside baseball. While Tom and I were working on this project, putting this book together, we had, how should I put it, friendly conversations with historians and revolutionary era experts. And when we mentioned, or when we told them, yes, our contention is Valley Forge is the turning point. We got a lot of, no. What are you kidding me? It was Trenton. No. It was the Battle of Saratoga. It was when the French got into the war. No, I'm sorry. It was when we trapped Cornwallis on the peninsula at Yorktown. Mm-hmm. So Tom and I talked about this. And listen, when we go out on the road to promote this book, as I'm doing right here on your radio program, we're going to have a good answer for this. Why do we think it was the turning point? And we have many good answers, and we think they're evident in the book. But then, deus ex machina, we sent out early review copies to historians. I don't know Joseph Ellis from Adam. Tom doesn't know him from Adam. He does not know us. We don't even write for the same publisher. But he is, well, I'd say his Pulitzer-winning Jefferson biography, his National Book Award-winning Washington book. He is the preeminent historian on the Revolutionary War. And he wrote back within 3 days of receiving an early copy of our book. He wrote back, Valley Forge was the existential moment in the War for Independence when the direction of American history hung in the balance. So now, Blake, when people like you ask me that question or contend that it wasn't, I say, you know what? Your argument's not with me. It's with Joe Ellis.
Right.
I'll give you his number. You can call him up.
So long story short, you made a very good case.
Yes, I believe
so. For Valley Forge being
the
pivotal moment.
I believe so. If Washington had not led that army out of Valley Forge in June of 1778, there would have been no more American Revolution. There would have been scattered guerrilla movements. New England, in particular, would have been hard to pacify. But the rest of the country would have fallen right in line. And that's how this book came about. I'll tell you a quick story.
Mm-hmm.
My son is now 21 years old. He's in university in the UK. So this had to be 6, 7 years. He was 13 or 14 years old. He's Franco-American. His mother is French.
Yeah.
And we were down at my wife's, his stepmother's house for holiday, Christmas it must have been. And I heard a kerfluffle in the TV room. And I saw Liam Antoine, is this my son's name, with a hyphen, Liam Antoine.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw him kind of storming out. I said, "What's going on, son?" My wife's brother had made some crack about the United States bailing the French out of 2 world wars. And he shot back, "Yeah, if it wasn't for the Marquis de Lafayette and the French army, you'd be Canada right now, pal. There would not even be a United States." Right. And not only was I proud of my 13, 14-year-old son for standing up to this 40-something-year-old man, but it was like a light bulb went off over our heads. I said, a Revolutionary War book. Tom, we haven't done that yet. We've done World War II. We've done Red Cloud, of course, who the only Indian to ever win a war, not a battle, a war against the United States. We've done Vietnam. We've done Korea. But we have not done the Revolutionary War. Let's dive into it. And what we found, what you don't know about Valley Forge is what you don't even think you know. There are so many myths, large and small. There are so many moments. And the more we dug into it, the more we realized what we learned in 8th grade history, social studies, civics classes, comes nowhere close to painting the true picture of what happened that winter.
You saying all that makes me think of two things in particular. One, is there one particular surprise that sticks out more than others? And two, why are there still surprises over 200 years later?
It's history. It's history, Blake. I mean, let me give you some small and large. One, Valley Forge, everybody seems to remember. Yeah, a bunch of half-naked, freezing soldiers starving to death. And let's see, what else do I know? May Washington sitting on a white horse watching them starve to death.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out that winter of 1777, 1778 was one of the most mild ever recorded in southeastern Pennsylvania.
That is not what is told.
No. Now, this is not to say they did not get hellacious snowstorms followed by ice storms. But then a week later, the temperatures would rise into the 40s, and they'd get 3 weeks of rain. And the rain would melt all the snow and flood the camp and overburden the latrines. And the horses who had starved to death, over 700 horses starved to death, who had been buried in freezing ground 3 weeks earlier, only a foot deep, they couldn't get any deeper.
Right.
Now they're floating up. And if there's one through line to the entire winter, we read so many journals and diaries and letters, and I personally read everything Washington wrote, or dictated more likely, between July 1, 1777 and July 15, 1778. I'm talking personal letters, public proclamations, memos, general orders, all his correspondence with Congress. If there's a through line through it all, it's how much that camp stunk. There was an odor hanging over it like an illness. So that's one little myth. Another one is like, oh, they were starving. And yes, they were starving. 2,000 men perished that winter, more than any other revolutionary battle, from a combination of malnutrition, starvation, disease. There must have been no food in the area. Wrong. There was plenty of food. The harvest of 1777 was the greatest of the decade. But the surrounding civilians, they didn't want to take worthless continental scrip for their cattle, for their oats, for their corn, for their sheep. So they smuggled it into British-occupied Philadelphia, where they were getting pounds sterling, sometimes even gold. But the biggest moment we already spoke about, Washington fighting that two-front war. I mean, who knew that? I mean, John Adams, he always had a thing for Washington. He never really liked him. Washington was, of course, a compromise candidate to become the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army. The firebrand New Englanders who started the Revolution, they knew they needed Virginia in the fight against the greatest empire in the world. Virginia was the most populous state, the richest state, the largest state. So, okay, Washington had made a reputation as an infantry commander during the French and Indian War, fighting alongside the British. So they appointed Washington, and Washington himself knew his limitations. Once again, it's Washington the man, not the man on the dollar bill. He scurried to find books on cavalry tactics, on military engineering, on artillery. He didn't know anything about this. Just as he learned about that, he also learned about politics. He learned how to fight these New Englanders. I mean, John Adams once quipped, "The only reason we made Washington the commander-in-chief is because he's always the tallest man in any room he walks into." There was always a kind of whispering campaign about Washington doesn't really know what he's doing. He might be a good field commander leading a company, a regiment, or a brigade, but he can't lead an army. And as Brandywine Creek happened, as Paoli happened, as Germantown happened, and as Horatio Gates is defeating an entire British army in the upstate New York hamlet of Saratoga, these whispers are becoming a low roar. Dr. Benjamin Rush, signer of the Declaration of Independence, noted Pennsylvania surgeon and an early Washington ally. He wrote the synonymous screed, calling Washington an autocratic dictator with no military experience or knowledge. Now, this became a pamphlet spread up and down the 13 colonies. Patrick Henry, a friend and ally of Washington, saw the original. He recognized Rush's handwriting. Mm-hmm. He wrote to Washington, said, "This is the kind of statesman you're up against." But Washington was learning to play politics as well as learning to lead an army. So if I may just follow that up by you, I know I've got a roundabout way of answering your question.
Oh,
but
you're fine.
As you can tell, Washington is my favorite character in this book, George Washington. But I think, given the political climate of our country right now, it's interesting, if not to say ironic, how many foreigners help secure our liberty. I mean, the hulking Bavarian, Johann de Kalb, who died for our liberty, who died at the Battle of Camden. When Horatio Gates cut and run, de Kalb stayed with a small coterie. It was almost like the Alamo. 11 bayonet charges he pushed back. 11 wounds he had until he finally fell on the 12th. Casimir Pulaski also died for our country, the father of the American cavalry. General Louis de Portel, the Frenchman, he was a military engineer par excellence, and he is known as the father of the American Army Corps of Engineers. There's so many more, and of course, the Marquis de Lafayette. But perhaps we want to talk about this later, because my second favorite character in this book is the Baron Friedrich Wilhelm Ludolf Gerhard Augustin von Steuben, von Steuben to you and I. This guy is the Falstaff of our book. Want me to keep going?
Please do. You're taking the words out of my mouth. You've covered a lot of the questions I was going to ask, so please continue.
All right. Well, I'll backtrack a little bit with the Marquis de Lafayette, who is this. He was 19 years old when he introduced himself to George Washington in Philadelphia in August of 1777. He turned 20 around the time of the Battle of the Brandywine, and he and George Washington just personally bonded.
And he sought out, like, he practically begged to come to America.
Oh, he was. In fact, he broke French law. He was one of the richest orphans in France.
Right.
And he outfitted his own ship with arms. And it was against the law then in France, although it was, France was surreptitiously backing us, but they weren't, they weren't technically yet at war with us. The Marquis de Lafayette broke the law by sailing here. And he was this young, eager, cult-like figure. And Washington saw a lot of his younger self in the Marquis de Lafayette, his eagerness for battlefield accolades, for honors. Washington was an insecure man. He never had a university degree. Right. When he fought with the British, he was a lieutenant colonel in the militia, which meant that lieutenants, majors, captains, regular British Army officers who technically ranked below him could order him around. He never forgot that. Lafayette showed an acceptance of George Washington's authority that Washington never forgot. He was wounded at the Battle of Brandywine Creek. Washington, he had only been in the United States no more than 6 weeks. They had bonded so closely by this time that Washington sought out the surgeons who were treating him and said, "Attend to him as if he is my own son."
Related to his wound, there were strong rumors in France that he had been killed.
Right.
What was at stake? If it had been proven true that he had been killed, you know, fighting for the independence of the American colonies, what would have been the result?
I think it might have been a blow. Maybe Americans don't want to hear this, but we would not have won the war without the French. My son was right.
Yeah.
And it would have been a despairing blow as opposed to a disparaging blow. And Washington knew this because not only did he have a personal affection for Lafayette, mm-hmm. but Lafayette was his backdoor lifeline to the French foreign minister, the Comte de Vergennes, who had the boy king, Louis XVI, here. The French were bitter over the reparations right. from the war. They wanted to get back at the hated roast biffs, they call them, the roast beefs.
Yes.
But they didn't have the money and they didn't know if they had the wherewithal. But it was Lafayette's letters from the United States extolling Washington, extolling the Continental Army, extolling the fight for liberty that eventually really bent. And of course, I'm not giving short shrift to Benjamin Franklin's diplomacy in mm-hmm. Paris, Silas Deane's diplomacy. But in combination, it was that pressure's too strong a word, urgings that finally convinced the French in February of 1778 to officially form an alliance with the United States, a treaty, and go to war with the British. So that's one foreigner, and I suppose we'll get to von Steuben at some point during this conversation.
Well, and again, you mentioned the youth of Lafayette. He wasn't the only young man in Washington's inner circle.
When we think about war these days, and I don't have to think about it too hard. I was a foreign correspondent. I was a war correspondent mm-hmm. for 20 years, and delightful places like Afghanistan and right. Iraq and Darfur and Sarajevo and Christ, at least in Belfast, you could get a beer at the end of the day, but nowhere else. And we think about our young men, our grunts. They all look like my son when he was 15. Mm-hmm. But the officers, Patton, World War II, Pershing, World War I, Westmoreland, Vietnam. I mean, these are older men. But not only were Washington's kind of homegrown generals, Nathaniel Greene from Rhode Island, Anthony Wayne, Pennsylvania, Mad Anthony Wayne, here in the sobriquet later in the war for good reason. These were men in their mid-30s. And then Washington personally was surrounded by Lafayette, 19, turns 20. His two most important aides-de-camp were Alexander Hamilton, 22 years old, and John Lawrence, 22 years old. I assume Ron Chernow and Lin-Manuel Miranda have covered Hamilton right. for me. We don't have to talk about him here today. But I'll say a little bit about John Lawrence. 22 years old, he was the son of Henry Lawrence, South Carolina delegate to the Continental Congress, who assumed the role of president when John Hancock resigned because of ill health. Now, John had been in London studying law when the revolution broke out. After receiving his university degree at Geneva, he flew back to the States. Quite literally, he took the fastest schooner he could find. And much to his father's chagrin, introduced himself to Washington and he wanted to fight. He was the idealist. He wanted to be in the thick of it. But Washington realized he needed this man not only for his smarts as an aide-de-camp, keep him close to me, but just as Lafayette was a back channel to the French, John Lawrence was a back channel to the Continental Congress. Now, of course, they had been driven out of Philadelphia and most of the delegates flew to the four winds. They returned to their home districts. But a small quorum anywhere at any given time that winter between 18 and 23 reconvened in the inland Pennsylvania town of York. They took over the courthouse, mm-hmm. became kind of a rump Continental Congress. So John and Henry, his father and son, they wrote. I mean, people back then just wrote all the time. They wrote twice a week. And it was John keeping George Washington apprised. Who's with you and who's against you? And here's what John Adams has to say, and here's what Ben Rush has to say, and here's how my father, who was a big, also a Washington acolyte. But getting back to your original question, even though I think if you might want to call a favorite son, it would definitely be Lafayette. But between Hamilton, Lawrence, and Lafayette, they were the three Washington surrogate sons. And I'm convinced, I call Lawrence the founding father you never heard of. I'm convinced he would have been our country's first Secretary of State. Except for in the waning days of the Revolutionary War, he finally escaped. He and Hamilton both escaped their inkwells, as they called it. Washington gave them commands of brigades. John Lawrence was outside his hometown of Charleston, South Carolina, shivering with malaria in a sickbed when he's informed the British has sent a foraging party out of Charleston. Blake, The British are weeks away from evacuating Charleston. They know the state is lost. They know the war is lost. Lawrence gets out of his sickbed to interdict this foraging party, and the company he's leading is ambushed by British scouts. Lawrence is shot off his horse and killed at the age of 27. That's why he's the founding father you never heard of.
Is there any one passage in particular in this entire volume that has kind of received more attention or more feedback than any others? I mean, there's so much to dig into.
At the risk of repeating myself, I think it's Washington the human being, mm-hmm. as opposed to Washington the iconic figure.
So just the running narrative about how he was so low and was facing so many different challenges.
And also how the generals, his own generals, wanted his job. Horatio mm-hmm. Gates, the hero of Saratoga, and the New Englanders were saying, well, wait a minute. Washington just lost at Brandywine. He lost the massacre to Paoli. He just lost it at Germantown. Gates just captured a British army of 5,000 men led by, I love this name, Gentleman Johnny Burgoyne, including 20 generals. Why isn't Gates leading the Continental Army?
Do you feel like he was kind of maybe a popular choice to replace Washington?
Well, in his own mind, he was. He thought he should have been the commander. He was a British-born who had fought in the French and Indian War, settled in what is now West Virginia, what was then Western Virginia on a plantation. And when war broke out, volunteered his services to the Continentals, assuming he would be named commander-in-chief. And he considered Washington a country bumpkin from the Virginia cow paths. And he simmered that Washington was named ahead of him. So Washington's having his travails in Pennsylvania. Gates is having his moment at Saratoga. Gates hears the rumors. He immediately moves to York, Pennsylvania, takes lodging, and starts lobbying the Continental Congress. Yeah, I'll take the job. Here's what I'll do. Here's what I'd do that he wouldn't do. Washington knows all this. So do his officers. I mentioned Nathaniel Greene, Mad Anthony Wayne, the triumvirate of kids, Hamilton, Lawrence. I call them kids, Hamilton, Lawrence, Lafayette. They're ready to resign. Mutiny, maybe. Washington is like, no, no. Let's just play this politically the correct way. He asks for a delegation to come out from York to inspect Valley Forge. The delegation of five congressmen get there. They're shocked. Well, Tom and I write that this was a half-naked army. We're not saying that metaphorically. These men, they see sentries, naked sentries with nothing but an old worn blanket covering them, barefoot, standing on their hats in the snow or the freezing mud. I mean, Philadelphia was only 23 miles away. The British knew exactly where the Americans were making their winter camp. They could follow the blood in the snow from their bare feet. So these delegates realize, wow, it's only George Washington's steely will. It's the troops' loyalty to Washington that is keeping this army together. Now, don't get me wrong. There were plenty of deserters. But those who remained, it's that old saying, that which doesn't kill me makes me stronger. Mm-hmm. For those 6 months, even though the rump end of the Continental Congress met in York, Tom and I also contend that Valley Forge, which during that winter was the sixth largest city in the United States, that was the beating heart of the Revolution. It was the capital of the United States, and Washington was the personification of the rebellion against the British. Now imagine having all that on your shoulders and still having to fight a war and still having to fend off political enemies. I mean, this is why I'm just in awe of this man who has probably looked down from me in every classroom I've been in and every courthouse I've been in. Here was a real human being. I think that's what really took us aback when we started digging into that.
So it sounds like everything you learned about Washington during this time not only solidifies his title as father of our country, but magnifies that role and that title, perhaps.
You're absolutely correct. In fact, just as an aside, the first time the phrase father of our country was applied to George Washington was during that winter of 1778, when a German language Pennsylvania newspaper called him that in German. I mean, we're jumping way ahead, but I'll give you another example. Washington wouldn't accept a third term as president of the United States because he did not want to die in office. And he did not want to set a precedent of a regal presidency. You serve till you die. He would have swept a third term, but he declined. So that is kind of in accordance with what you just said. I mean, he had his problems with so many of the foreign mercenaries were coming over. I mean, I love this word. Once a week, he would write to Franklin in Paris, "Stop sending me these popinjays." Wonderful word, popinjays. You know, and it was predominantly French soldiers of fortune who would set foot on the American coast and expect to be handed a general sash and put in charge of a brigade. And Washington couldn't stand this. "Stop sending me these people, please. I can't take it." But the ones that came over and did their job, the de Cobbs, the Pulaskis, the Lafayettes, the Duportails, he was willing to not only accept them, but to learn from them. Even though he outranked them, he wanted to learn from them. And there's nobody that epitomizes that more than the Baron von Steuben.
That trait that you're describing right there, his willingness to learn from those that technically were below him, how key was that trait in surviving this time?
It was key because everyone from his enlisted men to his junior officers to his senior officers to his generals, they realized that George Washington was a different kind of man. Although they all referred to him as Your Highness or called him in the third person His Highness. Washington did not like that, but he realized he couldn't dissuade them from doing that.
Wi-Fi'd it.
Yeah, exactly. But they all recognized in this man, not only is he leading us, but he's willing to learn from us. That's a different kind of general than we're used. You got to remember, the American army was only 2 years old.
Right.
We had no preconception of what it was like to be a soldier in a country's army. And in fact, the armies, before von Steuben got there, they were pretty much just a ragtag, bobtailed collection of militias. And they all did things different ways.
So you talked about how Washington had been in command of the militia during the French and Indian War and how he wasn't given a lot of respect for that reason. In like manner, pretty much the entire American militia was the same way, right? Aren't you essentially saying they had no professional training whatsoever?
The Continental Army that camped at Valley Forge in the winter of 1777, 1778, if General Howe, the British commander of all British troops in the United States, and his brother, General William Howe, and his brother, Lord Richard, who was in charge of the Royal Navy in the United States, if they had ventured out of Philadelphia at any point, they would have totally overrun the winter encampment at Valley Forge. They knew it. Washington knew it. But it was a combination of luck and British hubris. Basically, they said back then there were fighting seasons, and this was not the fighting season. And they said, listen, we brushed this rabble off our shoulders like lint at Brandywine Creek. We massacred them at Paoli. We routed them at Germantown. Let's enjoy the urbane delights of Philadelphia for the winter, what urbane delights there were at the time.
Right.
And come spring, we'll take care of them. Come spring, we'll knock them out and the war will be over. This rebellion, this treasonous rebellion will be over.
And I remember you mentioned something early on in the book about the surprising manners and rules of war during this time.
Some of the stuff was just crazy. During one skirmish, it was at Germantown, as a matter of fact, as the Continental Army was retreating, they somehow picked up a dog and its collar showed that it belonged to General Howe. And Washington had Alexander Hamilton clean it, brush it, and sent back with his compliments. At another time, Howe sent a note to Washington declaiming the fact that someone had shot on his flag bearer. Washington actually sent an apology. "We know we don't shoot at flag bearers. We apologize for that." Dan Morgan later became a general. He was a colonel in the Continental Army. He and his Virginia sharpshooters, a regiment of Virginia sharpshooters, they were the only outfit that had rifles. Everyone else had muskets. And Dan Morgan was known for telling his sharpshooters, "Take out the big geese first." In other words, shoot the officers off their horses. The British couldn't believe somebody would fight a war in such a disrespectful manner. And Dan Morgan, who was a backwoodsman, cousin of Daniel Boone, he had traipsed all throughout Kentucky with Daniel Boone. They had broken trail together. He was like, "Wait a minute. Are we fighting a war to kill people here, or are we trying to do some kind of minuet?"
I probably was in middle school. I remember one of my old history teachers talking about how one of the reasons why we won is because we kind of adopted guerrilla tactics. Is that kind of what you're talking about there, or is that going too far?
Kind of, sort of, maybe. But I got to tell you, Blake, one of the greatest myths of the American Revolution, the triumph of the American Revolution, is that of the Continental Minuteman with musket tucked away, creeping through a copse of woods or crouched behind a boulder and picking off the squared British regiments one by one. Mm-hmm. Now, yes, our homegrown Indian fighting ways certainly helped us in this war. But even Washington realized by February and March of 1778, he was at sixes and sevens. He said, I can't fight this army. I can't fight the most feared army in the world. Actually, Frederick the Great's Prussian army was probably the most feared army in the world. But I can't fight the largest army in the world with this collection of militia. These Fabian tactics, named after the Roman general Fabius, who held back the Carthaginian Hannibal. These Fabian tactics will stall, but they won't win a war for us. I need a professional army. And that's where the Baron von Steuben came in. He arrived at Valley Forge in late February. He's a Falstaffian character, as I mentioned. He arrived on a sleigh, adorned with 24 jingle bells, and pulled by a team of coal-black Percheron horses he had purchased in France just to make a grand entrance. Of course, he had purchased the horses on borrowed money because he was flat broke. In his wake was his retinue of aides and attendees and translators. He had no English. He was fluent in French and German. And he brought a French chef from Paris to Valley Forge. The man was there 36 hours before he packed up and went back to France. But the Baron, Washington rode out to meet him. We can only imagine, because Washington never wrote about it, what he thought about meeting the Baron was not a young man. He was in his mid-40s. He had an ample belly, he had a double chin, and he's dressed in a fur-lined robe with two big horse pistols. He's holding his pocket greyhound in his lap. The horse, the dog's name was Azor. But what endears me to the Baron von Steuben was that he showed up at Valley Forge with a resume more doctored up than the Mayo Clinic. I mean, this man was no more a baron than I am or you are. But what happened was, should I make this story short? Are we running out of time? What happened was, von Steuben had knocked around and he had risen to the rank of captain in the Prussian army. Frederick the Great's Prussian army at the time was not the largest army. In fact, it was rather small, but it was one of the most feared in the Western world. And Frederick the Great was known as the greatest military mind in the Western world. And what Frederick the Great did in his army that no other Western army did, including Washington's Continental Army, was he made the officers live and bunk and eat with the enlisted men. All the other armies, the officers felt this was beneath them. Mm-hmm. They left that training, so to speak, to the NCOs, to the sergeants, to the corporals, not the Prussians. So von Steuben came up through the ranks of the Prussian army, as did Frederick the Great, willing to doff their general's coats and get down on their bellies in the muck and mire with their soldiers to take bayonet practice or to practice a wheeling, a quick step march. When Baron von Steuben was introduced to Silas Deane and Benjamin Franklin in Paris by the Count de Vergennes, who realized this is the man the American army needs, Franklin and Deane are like, oh no, not another one. Not another one. Washington's going to kill us if we send any more of these popinjays over here. Took him 3 or 4 interviews to realize, to come around to the Count de Vergennes, this is the man we need. This man will turn our disparate militias into a professional army.
What did they see different between him and all
the
others?
He was willing to get down and work. And unlike other foreigners who came over and kind of looked down on the bumpkin Americans. Uh-huh. And I'll give you a perfect example. Once von Steuben, the Baron von Steuben, was more or less ensconced as the drill master of Valley Forge, he wrote a letter back to a fellow Prussian army officer saying, these Americans are different. They have no built-in history. They don't have hundreds of years of tradition. So when we say to one of our French soldiers or Prussian soldiers or Austrian soldiers or Polish or Italian, when we say attack over there, they attack over there. When I tell these Americans attack over there, they ask me why. All the other foreign officers were, you don't ask me why. I'm an officer, that's why. Von Steuben was willing to work with these enlisted men and explain why. Because if I have you circle and quick step around there, I could bring my artillery up on their flank. That's why. And he wrote to his compatriot in Prussia, once you explain to these Americans why, they will run through fire for you. And they did. And in the beginning, Washington was so impressed with von Steuben. In his first week there, he went on his own little mini inspection tour, and he started bombarding Washington with memos of everything from, are you nuts? Your latrines are running right through your bread kitchen. To, let's lay out some regimental lanes in front of these huts these men are living in. Give them a sense of being a true professional army. So Washington took his 50-man personal guard, added 50 more soldiers to it, and said to von Steuben, train these 100 men, and then they will spread out throughout the army as your sub-trainers. No one else, he put out a general order, no one else to train unless it's von Steuben or one of von Steuben's sub-trainers. So every day, von Steuben would gather these 100 men on the parade grounds at Valley Forge, and thousands of other soldiers would surround to watch. They really had nothing else to do. And von Steuben, true to his training, would get down on that ample belly of his in the mud to teach them how to read terrain, get on his knees and muddy his uniform to teach them that when they are sticking a bayonet in someone's gut, this is how you twist it, to teach them what quick march was, how to wheel in formation. His very first day as the drill master, he spent the entire morning teaching them the proper way to stand at attention. This not only ingratiated von Steuben to the enlisted men, but it is also during this period that you'll understand why I say he's my second favorite character of this book. He was this Falstaffian character, and Washington had a sign. Hamilton and John Lawrence followed von Steuben around like a couple of Prince Hal's following Falstaff around. And von Steuben, with his prickly Prussianness, if anyone made a mistake during his training, his face would get beet red, and he'd throw away his riding crop, and he would flail his arms, and he would yell to his translator, Hamilton Lawrence, in French, get over here and curse for me. And I said before he had no English, I am wrong. He had one word in English. Damn. So Hamilton would come by his side, and von Steuben, a string of oaths and curses in French, in Prussian, punctuated by the occasional damn, would come out of his mouth. And then by the time Hamilton translated, the American soldiers who were being trained were doubled over in laughter, saying, we love this man. This man is one of us. The junior officers, von Steuben, being a foreign delegate, he was given a farmhouse. He had a little more rations than most the other officers. He would invite the lieutenants, the captains, the majors to his farmhouse for meals on one condition. As I said, naked soldiers, you could not have pants, or your pants had to be in rags in order to come to one of von Steuben's dinners. He would call them his sans-culottes suppers. And on the many occasions when he was invited to Washington's headquarters for dinner, he would entertain the French-speaking officers' wives with ribald tales of the European salons. But despite this kind of clownish, Falstaffian aspect to him, he was the real deal. The very last communique, the very last letter Washington ever wrote as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army in 1783 was to the Baron von Steuben, Count von Steuben, he called him, thanking him for turning this bobtail collection of militias into a well-oiled professional army.
You've mentioned many different cosmopolitan aspects of this ragged fighting force that became the American Army, French, German, Prussian, on and on. There were also several free black soldiers.
You know, that's one of the huh moments. At the very beginning, we were talking about myths. Wasn't that cold all the time? Yeah. There was plenty of food around.
Right.
This isn't so much a myth as a moment. When I give presentations and I say, does anyone in this room realize there were 750 black Continental soldiers at Valley Forge? No one knew.
Don't think I knew.
No one knew. They were all free men, many of them born free in New England, but some of them were freed slaves from New England farms. Their owners had been compensated. And Rhode Island was the first to put together a black battalion, and they fought so ferociously that Connecticut followed suit soon after, as did Massachusetts, New York. In fact, John Lawrence wrote to his father that he wanted to do the same in South Carolina. And his father, Henry, said, John, South Carolina is not exactly Connecticut, so that's not going to happen. Although, eventually, later in the war, Washington allowed him to try, but the state politicians would not let him.
Interesting.
But this was the last time Black Americans fought alongside white Americans until the Korean War. I understand there were black regiments and brigades in the Civil War, in World War I, and World War II, but they were segregated. This was the last time that a white American would fight next. The first man whose death was recorded at Valley Forge on Christmas morning, 1777, was a black Connecticut soldier named Jethro. We don't have a last name on him. He was found in his cabin, starved to death, combination of exposure and starvation. And people are like, huh? There were black soldiers fighting? Well, yes, there were. Yes, there were.
So there any record, I don't know, impressions or interactions that von Steuben had with black soldiers in particular?
Von Steuben was pretty colorblind. It was that whole Prussian thing. There were ripples. I mean, there were, every state was represented at Valley Forge except for South Carolina, except for John Lawrence, which was busy defending Charleston, and Georgia, which was not a real populous state to start with. It was more or less a British military outpost. Mm-hmm. But the Continental soldiers down there, or the militia, I should say, they were busy defending the port of Savannah. So every state except for those two were present at Valley Forge. And of course, the soldiers from Virginia, from North Carolina, even Delaware to an extent, they did not look kindly on the Rhode Islanders and the Connecticuters putting up black regiments. Nobody much liked the Catholic Marylanders. And everybody pretty much hated the New Yorkers. Some things never change, I suppose. And even the Pennsylvania troops, some of the, because the surrounding countryside where everyone was smuggling goods into it, when William Penn, of course, founded Pennsylvania, it was an open religious state, and he welcomed all these different religious sects, the Mennonites, the Dunkers. And to the troops from other parts of the country, they kind of all fell under the rubric Quakers. Mm-hmm. And many a Continental soldier went to his deathbed years and years later, cursing those damn Quakers for not selling us any food.
So again, we've touched a little on how there are those that just don't really, either they don't know or they don't want to acknowledge the role that France has had at key points in our history, and not to the least this point in history. So you mentioned quite a few significant details in your epilogue. Talk a little bit about Lafayette and his role in all of this.
Well, people forget, or people probably didn't even know. In fact, I didn't know. I don't think we're taught. But when Lafayette returned to France, he wasn't quite a Republican and he wasn't quite a monarchist. He was unfortunately caught in the middle. So Robespierre and that group, they didn't trust him, and the king didn't trust him. And as it turns out, he was eventually labeled an outlaw. He tried to escape back to the United States. He was thrown into prison in Austria for years and years and years. And Washington was besieged by James Monroe, this is Lafayette. How can you let him? And Washington, sticking to his no entangling alliances. We are not getting caught up in these European wars. Even though there were a couple of jailbreaks tried, Hamilton worked with his sister-in-law to try to break Lafayette out. But long story short, Lafayette's roaming's over and he returns to the United States in the 1820s. And he's an old man now and he's bent over and he's on it. And of course, Washington is long dead and Jefferson is dead and all the Green and Anthony Wayne, they're all gone. Lafayette is the last of the living American Revolutionary War generals. And by this time, don't hold me to this, but I think there might be 22 states. Lafayette visits every one of them.
Wow.
At Bunker Hill, he instructs his son, George Washington Lafayette, to put dirt in a bag from Bunker Hill and spread it over his grave. He returns to France. He dies a few years later of pneumonia, still trying to affect French politics. So, however many years later, I can't add it in my head, but on July 4th of 1917, at the height of World War I, the initial 200 soldiers of Black Jack Pershing, General Pershing's first American expeditionary force, they reach Paris. And the first thing they do is Pershing's aide-de-camp was a colonel named Edwin Stanton, who was the great-nephew or maybe the great-grandnephew of Lincoln's Secretary of War, Stanton. Pershing leads a small coterie, including Stanton, to the grave of Lafayette, where Lafayette's son has sprinkled the dirt centuries earlier, over his father's grave. And Stanton reads, he said, in French, he reads, but I'll say it in English, America has joined forces with the Allied powers. And what we have in blood and treasure are yours. Lafayette, nous sommes ici et retournés. Lafayette, we are here, we have returned. It brings goosebumps when you think about it. What, the memory, the military memory. You know, okay, it's our turn to give back. Anyway, did for me.
Is Lafayette seen as a hero in France?
Yes, he is these days, yes. At the time, once again, he was caught in that middle ground because as much as he admired and fought for the American Republic, he did not see France as a country that would accept a democratic republic. So he wanted France to kind of tread that middle line between a federal monarchical republic, so what England is right now. And so nobody trusted him. And he was one of those lone prophets, a voice in the wilderness that nobody listened to.
So it sounds like you're saying, really, he's more of a hero in France.
No, I think he's more of a hero in the United States than he is in France.
Like he's acknowledged here as a hero?
Well, look at all the counties that are named after him, all the towns that are named after him.
That is true.
I mean, I came up from Mississippi. And I drove through a county that's spelled Lafayette, but it's pronounced,
right.
I can't remember how it's, Lafayette. And I actually said to, I was at a bookstore and I said, why is it Lafayette County? And I said, because that's the way we like it. You know,
right.
I said, okay, that's good enough. As long as you get the name, as long as you get the spelling right. So
honor the man.
Right. And because Lafayette was probably the most important, but you can't over, I mean, both DeKalb and Pulaski gave their lives.
Talk a little bit more about Pulaski. What role did he play in
particular? Casimir Pulaski, this dashing, always wore black, a black sable, jet black hair and a big black mustache. And he came over and from Polish Lithuania at the time were under the Russian domain.
Mm-hmm.
And he had led revolutions against the Russians, which always resounded in defeat. And so finally, running for his life, broke. Even though he was technically a Count Pulaski, but he arrived on our shores and he approached Washington and said, listen, you do not have a cavalry. You have a disparate set of mail riders and scouts and a few Virginia sharpshooters who happen to have horses. Give them to me and I will turn them into a working cavalry. And he did. And much like von Steuben, in a short amount of time.
Sounds similar.
Because it was at the Battle of Brandywine Creek. Pulaski had not been here for, well, certainly less than a year, for maybe 6-7 months. And it was his small cavalry, no more than 200 horses, that kind of screened the retreat of the Continental Army from Brandywine Creek. It's just amazing. These men... Yes, of course they were soldiers of fortune, Pulaski's case, but so many cases, Lafayette being the prime example, they came over to fight for liberty, for the concept of liberty, not so much, well, yes, of course, for American liberty, but for the idea of liberty. That meant something to them. I mean, even John Lawrence, he had studied in Geneva, home of the Enlightenment. You know, he's writing to his father from South Carolina, hey, Dad, let's raise a brigade of slaves. And his father, like, you could almost see his father slapping his forehead saying, are you nuts? We're talking about Charleston. John Lawrence's father, Henry Lawrence, had made his fortune operating one of the biggest slave trading houses in the United States. And here's his son saying, let's free slaves and have them fight for us. Just, sometimes the crazier things are the crazy but true is how you look at it. So.
Tell me about the Hessians and any animosity there might have been between them and any of the other delegates there
to
help out.
Well, first of all, true. I mean, ultimate soldiers of fortune. I believe there were 6 margraves or principalities in what was then Prussia that sold or rented soldiers to King George III. And because 2 of them started with the word Hess, all German soldiers in the United States became known as Hessians. And the Hessians were, I mean, let's face it, marauding armies of the era. When they came through your village or your town, hide the women, children, cattle, and corn, because they're going to take it. But the Hessians were particularly vicious among American civilians. There was a historian who's unfortunately right now, Blake, whose name I'm not going to remember, but it's pretty much accepted because of him that when revolution broke out, there was 40% for revolution, 20% hardened loyalists, and the other 40% of the population of the Americas, which is about 2 million at the time, kind of went either way, depending on who was winning, depending on what army was in your neighborhood, depending on what your neighbors thought. And it was the Hessians who did a great deal towards turning that 40% of undecideds towards the United States with their atrocities. They didn't even like the British. They knew they were here to be being paid to fight, and the British didn't trust the Hessians.
So was it fair to say that, kind of in light of all of that, that bringing the Hessians over was another act of hubris by the British?
Yes. Hubris is a great word when you're talking about the British and the American Revolution. You can't go wrong using the word hubris. I mean, there are strength in numbers.
Yes.
And the Hessians, I got to say, they get a bad rap for Washington's Christmas Day surprise victory at Trenton. They were all hung over on Christmas Day. They weren't. They were not exactly prepared for a surprise raid. But I think Washington deserves more credit than the Hessians deserve a bad rap. And let's face it, the more people you have in your invading army, when Gentleman Johnny Burgoyne is marching on Albany, and, well, he's got an army of 6,000, and including 1,500 Hessians, singing their Lutheran fight songs as they take Fort Ticonderoga, it's scary. And in the end, it didn't matter. But then again, either the Scots or the Redcoats. The Scots were fearsome, too. The British had several companies or brigades of Scots over here who would charge with their Celtic war cries and scare the hell out of you when they're coming down on you in the middle of the night.
We could talk probably for hours and hours about this book. Surprise after surprise, new information upon new information, that it really casts such a new light on Valley Forge and its importance.
We could almost sum it up by saying the United States was born in the Age of Enlightenment. And the founders, they were determined not to follow the martial European idea of a nation state, that might makes right morality. Mm-hmm. They had the novel idea that thinking and having thorough arguments about where our country, the direction our country is headed, but not arguments that degenerate into partisanship.
Right.
Now, it might have been a golden age, and in many ways it was. I'll give you a perfect example. Washington had his farewell dinner with his officer corps in a place in Lower Manhattan, New York, Francis Tavern. It's still there. And this was in 1783. The owner served shad, and everyone loved Francis Tavern shad roe. Years later, a decade later, Washington is now president. He is back in Francis Tavern, meeting with a dignitary. They're sharing a glass of Madeira wine, Washington's favorite, by the way. And the owner, Thomas Frantz, I believe his name was, puts down a plate of shad in front of Washington and his guest. And Washington looks up startled and says, "What is this? We did not order this." And the owner, Frantz, says, "Oh, no, Your Highness. This is just our small version of a thank you." And Washington replies, let me make sure I get this right, "It shall never be said that the President of the United States indulges in such luxuries." Can you imagine any politician from either party saying that today? Mm-hmm. Even thinking that. It wouldn't even come to their minds to think that. So I guess that's what we're talking about here, how it was a different time. And I believe, in our context, is without George Washington, we would be Canada right now. He was the man to, at the right time, at the right place, to lead us out of the shackles of British colony.
With all that was going on during that time, it does seem hard to fathom that anybody else could navigate it in quite the same way that he did.
Politically, militarily, the equanimity that he just kept, whether he was dealing with a private first class or with the president of the Continental Congress, he could see, whereas Alexander Hamilton to John Adams was, as he put it, the bastard son of a Scottish peddler. Alexander Hamilton was born out of wedlock in the island of Nevis. Washington saw in Hamilton someone who would not only spark this revolution, but later in the early nascent stages of the United States. In John Lawrence, who unfortunately was killed, he saw the same thing. In the Marquis de Lafayette, he saw the same thing. In his homegrown generals, and that's another reason that the British board generals who fought for the United States, they were jealous of Nathaniel Greene, of Mad Anthony Wayne. Washington had, he stopped keeping a journal. He was named commander-in-chief because he didn't want to be captured and have that journal fall into enemy hands. But he did write one general order that was kept private and only shared with the Continental Congress. He advised the delegates that should he fall in combat, General Greene be named as his successor, not the British-born Horatio Greats, not the British-born Charles Lee. These are all self-taught men. Henry Knox, right, a Boston bookseller who, when the British blockaded the Boston Harbor, could not get any more books, so closed his shop and started teaching himself artillery was all about. How to use cannons, how to use howitzers, what's the difference?
Right.
He became George Washington's chief artillery officer. I mean, it's just hard to fathom. I mean, there was no West Point. There was no Naval Academy. Yes, we had help from foreigners, but basically we were a self-taught military, just like we were a self-taught country.
It's the American way.
Yeah, I guess so. It certainly was back then.
Well, Drury, I think that's all the time we have for today. Bob Drury is the author of Valley Forge, published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, Blake, this was fun. Thank you.
And all the sharing you had. I mean, we could go on for hours and hours, I'm sure.
Unfortunately, we could, but we'd need a couple bottles of wine.
Right. I'm Blake McVeigh, and this has been Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work, but there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.